Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is Sean Mielke from the band Alisana and founder of Revival Recordings. But first, there is really good news for the recorded music business as the 2016 numbers were released by the RIAA. And what we found was that the music business brought in $7.7 billion last year, and that was up 11.4%. Why was that impressive? Well, for the first time in almost 20 years, growth in recorded music was up double digits. That hasn't happened since 1998. Now, of that $7.7 billion, streaming was worth $3.9 billion, and that was up a full 69%. What's even better is the fact that each stream was worth 0.0072 cents. And it doesn't sound like a lot, but the fact of the matter is, the year before it was only 0.005, and the year before that it was only 0.00666. So the per stream rate has gone up, and that's a really good thing. One of the bad things, though, was we found out that YouTube no longer reports if an artist is getting less than 1,000 streams per day. So in other words, there's a whole lot of streams that are not being reported. Your video has to do at least 1,000 streams a day in order for them to report the revenue. So that means there's a whole lot of revenue that's probably not coming back to the labels, which means it's not coming back to the artist. That's a bad thing. So we'll see how that shakes out in the coming year, because there's probably going to be a lot of gnashing of teeth over that in corporate label boardrooms. Another thing that happened last year was the fact that 99.4 million CDs were sold, and that was worth a little over $1 billion. Now, the bad part is the fact that that's the lowest amount since 1986. So, boy, CDs are going away fast, although it's still a billion-dollar business. So you can't really sneeze at that. Downloads as well, going away quickly. They were down 22% last year, but it's still a $1.8 billion business. Now, something else that really came to pass last year, and we kind of saw that and predicted it, was the fact that it looks like the vinyl fad has peaked. The revenue was up about 3.5% to $430 million, but really the sales, the number of vinyl records that were sold were only up 1.8% to 17.2 million. That's 17.2 million vinyl records as compared to 99.4 million CDs. So there's a big, big disparity there. What's even worse about that is the fact that for the last 4 years, from 2012, the growth rate in vinyl was up 36% or more every single year. So now it looks as if what's happening is vinyl has hit its peak. We'll see what happens this year, but it sure looked like it. In the middle of last year, we can pretty much tell what was happening. And I think now we've kind of seen that maybe it's not going to go any higher than this. Hopefully it'll just level out and stay where it's at. And that'll be still pretty good. It's a good business. But hopefully it'd be nice if it would raise a little bit. So revenue numbers for 2016 for the music business really look good. To put it all in perspective, though, they're still down by about half of at their peak in 1999. So lots of reason to celebrate. But when you look at the big picture, the fact of the matter is that we're still way, way down from the good days. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. If you want to learn more about the basics of mixing, sign up for my 4-week Mixing Primer webinar course. You can go to mixingprimer.com to learn more. That's Mixing Primer, all one word, to learn more. Also, check out my new Hitmakers Club for access to all my courses, monthly workshops and Q&A webinars, core basic training, and much, much more. Go to hitmakersclub.com to find out all about it. Now, let's talk about good assistants. We're seeing fewer and fewer assistant engineer jobs these days because there are fewer and fewer commercial studios. Nonetheless, a lot of the things that makes a good assistant also makes a good studio owner, because frequently a studio owner has to act like an assistant when someone new comes into the studio. There's really 10 steps here to make a good assistant. A lot of these came from the great Al Schmidt. So let me give them to you and we'll put them in perspective here. The first one is good assistants know every piece of gear in the studio inside and out. Now, of course, if you're the owner of the studio, that probably goes without saying. But if someone's coming into your studio as an assistant, really, he has to take the time to learn everything. Number two is good assistants know the acoustics of all the live spaces. Now, again, if it's your studio, you probably know that already because you've tried just about everything, so you know what sounds good where and what sounds bad. But for an assistant coming in cold, has to ask everybody to find out, but also has to play himself to figure out what really sounds good, where do people like to place things, and have that information available for the next client. Number three is good assistants know every mic in the studio very well. You have to know which mics work, which mics are kind of funny, which mics might sound good in certain musical gear and won't sound good on other gear, but mostly it's the condition of the microphones, if something sounds funky or not. You really got to know that. Number four, good assistants are well-versed in Pro Tools. Now, Pro Tools is a universal digital audio workstation these days, and every commercial studio has to have it. That doesn't mean that private studios have to, and many private studios don't have it. Nonetheless, if you're going to hire your studio out, you better have Pro Tools on it because so many people want to use it, especially the higher budgets and especially the pros. So it's really a good thing to learn, even if you plan not using it in the course of your own music creation. Number five, this may be the top of all the list of everything here. Good assistants have great personal hygiene. Nobody wants to be stuck in a room with someone who doesn't smell good, has an odor. So it's really important that a good assistant, a studio owner, anybody who's going to be in the studio all day with other people, that they bathe regularly and that they smell really good. Number six, good assistants are transparent. That basically means they're seen and not heard. They never offer an opinion, even when people ask them, and they stay out of the way, and they kind of blend into the woodwork. That's what we want from an assistant. And it's very rare that someone will ask an opinion, and it's even rarer that an assistant will actually give it. So good assistants have to remain transparent. If it's you that's renting out the studio and you're acting as an assistant, it's really hard to keep your trap shut, but it's something that's pretty important. Number seven, good assistants admit mistakes. What that means is if you make a mistake at something, you don't try to skate around it. In fact, you say, "I'm sorry, I made a mistake." That's all people want, and no matter how bad the mistake, people can forgive it as long as they know about it. Number eight, good assistants don't guess. That means if there's something that you don't know, you say, "Look, I'm sorry, I don't know, but I'll find out." Again, if you try to get around it by either guessing or saying, you know, something that maybe isn't exactly true, then you're going to be found out and you really look bad. So the best thing is don't guess. Number nine, good assistants keep a notebook. And what that means is you really keep tabs on the session, especially if the session is going to be coming back to the studio for multiple days. If it's a one-off thing, you'd still want to do that, but even so, it's imperative if the client is going to be there for a week or more, then it's really important that you do keep a notebook and keep really good notes on what's happening in the session, because I guarantee you'll need them later on. And last but not least, good assistants know how to make coffee. Coffee is the fuel that makes sessions go, especially late ones. So it's important that you know how to make a good cup of coffee. And if you can't do that, hopefully you know there's a Starbucks down the street and you can run really quickly and get some if you need. So those are the 10 things that good assistance engineers should know or should practice. And with that, everyone who owns a studio that's actually bringing in outside clients should know them too. Sean Mielke toured with his band Alisana almost constantly since 2004, but decided that he both wanted to take some time off the road and get more control of the distribution process. He started Revival Recordings in 2013 with the mantra of good music by good people, and the label is currently distributed by Artery, Sony Red. He recently published his first novel, and he plans to launch Revival Rock School later in the year. I spoke with Sean via Skype from the Revival offices in North Carolina. You started with the band, and then it turned into a label, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, when the band started to take off and we started to tour and play shows and things like that, I always wanted to be learning when I was out on the road, you know, so I would pick the brains of anybody I could find and wanted to learn every single aspect of the industry because I knew eventually one day I wanted to start a company that did things a little bit differently, kind of found its own little corner of the industry to sit in. You know, I wanted it to be all about the people making the music and the music and the art itself. And that's not to say that other companies don't do that, but I really wanted that to be my primary focus. That was what I did with my own art, you know, for my whole life. And I wanted to be able to sort of pass the baton once I was done, you know, full-time touring and things. And I wanted to be able to take my experiences and the things I'd learned and be able to pass them on to younger bands.
Okay. So let's go back to the band then, because you had a lot of time touring and everything before you actually got into the label, right?
Oh, absolutely. We started, you know, when you start things, like, when did it actually start, you know? But I would say officially when we had the members we wanted and everything like that was in 2004. So we've been going at about 13 years. And we were definitely a DIY, do it from the ground up kind of band. Always did it our own way, you know, despite any advice we might be given along the way. We wanted to make sure that we were always doing things the way we envisioned it. Especially artistically. We never wanted to sacrifice the art we were making for any sort of, you know, shortcuts or anything like that. And I would say that the type of fan base we've built over that time is largely due to that fact. I think the fans that have stuck with us through the long haul have really recognized that we are creating something that we want to last forever. We want the art to move on even beyond, you know, us and our time on stage.
How did you build your fan base?
So in the early days, I would say we were part of the MySpace revolution, really, when MySpace was first allowing artists to really have a worldwide reach. We went all in on that, you know, and we were one of the early bands who would interact with every fan we could find online. We kind of did everything through that avenue. And I think what that did was build an international fan base that we didn't even realize we were necessarily building. The country players. So we had never played for more than 50 or 60 people here in the States. And we got into Mexico and played a sold out venue somewhere like the 650 ballpark. And we just were blown away by it. To this day, we don't necessarily understand why we have such a popularity down in those parts. But I think it was largely, again, because that was when internationally fans were able to have access to American bands so much more easily than they had in the past. And we really encouraged that, and we just interacted with all fans the same way.
Wow. So then you credit MySpace then. How about other social media, other aspects of social media then? Because MySpace came and went. What did you do after that?
The interesting thing is that we built a huge following on Facebook, right around 3 million followers on there.
Wow.
But I think that was more of a rollover from MySpace, because again, that was really what we used in the beginning parts. I personally don't think Facebook has ever made music and art as easy to promote as MySpace did. They throw up tons of walls, and especially these days. I mean, it's, you know, you're only able to touch a very small percentage of your fan base on there. And so I don't know. I think it was more we built the fan base through MySpace, but then we maintained our fan base through very, very vigorous touring. There was a six, seven, 8 year stretch there where we never did less than 250, 260 dates a year. Several of those years, over 300 dates a year. And that's worldwide, you know, US and otherwise. So I think we were able to create our fan base with social media, but we maintained it by constantly being accessible on stage.
That's really difficult these days when you're talking about 250, 300 dates a year. I mean, back when I first started, it was easy because there are plenty of venues. There were tons of venues as compared to now where there's not that many. So how did you do that? That's amazing to me because I know that a lot of times you only have venues that are open on the weekend. So how do you manage that?
Sure. I mean, I'll speak to both your points there. One thing I would agree with you on is the lack of venues now, especially now. You know, the venue we sort of grew up in, so to speak, or we built our local following a couple of years ago was knocked down to build a parking lot, you know, and we're seeing that everywhere. All of our favorite venues that, you know, we fell in love with as we began our touring career are gone. But I think in the early days of our touring, it was kind of any show, anytime, any place for us, you know, that was really our motto. And, you know, we've sort of lived by 5 people, 5,000 people, same show, no matter what. You know, the fans are going to get that same experience because our whole theory was everybody pays the same price for it. So it's not fair to the one kid in the crowd who loves our band just because 4,000 other people didn't show up, he deserves the same show. I always think back to a time we played a bowling alley in the very first couple months of our touring. Two people showed up, and they stood so far back that the lights just made it so that we didn't even see people. So we basically played for a floor, and but you know, gave the same performance because we knew they were back there somewhere.
That's what you're supposed to do.
Right.
Really.
Exactly.
I mean, and unfortunately, too many people don't think of it like, I have to agree, I was pretty much the same way. You know, when I first started, it was like, wow, it's really hard because there's nobody there. It's really easy when you got a lot of people. It's hard when there's not.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And unfortunately, I think that's a big problem with today's climate of up-and-coming bands is, I think with the accessibility of information and the way you can so easily contact fans online and things, I think bands just expect, oh, we have 3,500 likes on Facebook, so every show we play, there's going to be hundreds of kids, and then they get there and there's not, and then they back out of touring, and like that's just not how I did it. And so I preach it to my bands on the label all the time. Like, the way you get it is you go out and you earn it, and you're going to separate yourself from the pack of bands today by being that hardworking DIY kind of band.
Well, okay, let's get to the label then. So how did that come about?
So around 2012 was when we started pumping the brakes a little bit on touring so vigorously. I was married in 2011. My son was born in 2012. So that felt like the right time to start planning ahead, so to speak. And I was like, might as well put the wheels in motion. And I kind of just made it up as I went along in the early part of it. It was like, you know, the information I'd gleaned from labels I'd been signed to and managers I'd worked with, and tried to apply as much of that knowledge. But really, like everything else I've done artistically and whatnot, I just wanted to practice at it. So I found friends' bands, and my sister had always wanted to do a project, so I did a project with her, and I kind of just did it. I just put it out, and I tried to make as many mistakes as I could, because for me, that's where you really figure out how to do stuff, is by making those mistakes and failing at it and realizing what not to do. And so 2013 was when it started to really start to feel like something. Like, I think people were recognizing that it existed. My fan base from Alisana were starting to kind of catch on to what I was doing. And, but I'd say 2014 was really when it was like, okay, this is something we can do. And I started to bring some people on board to help me out. And, you know, today here in 2017, I've got a staff of 9 people who are all an internship status. But I only bring on people who genuinely care about the message we're trying to send and what it is we're trying to do. That's a huge criteria for being on board. And proud to say that, you know, we're distributed now by Artery Recordings and Sony Red, and every single day is just like more work and more how did I get here so quickly kind of thing.
One of the things that I've noticed whenever I've done projects for a label that was owned by a musician, that it had a distinct different feeling. And I'm talking about a small indie label for the most part. And the feeling kind of is the musician, that the label exec, you know, if you will, is a big fan of all the people that they're bringing in, all the people that they're working with, as opposed to looking at it as kind of a business venture. It's more like, boy, I'm really a fan. I think this is really cool. So that's why I want to do it. And I suspect that's the same with you. I just get that feeling.
Oh, sure. I mean, most of my days at work, I feel like a kid in a candy store. You know, I get to listen through music and decide which of it I love and try to bring it on board and be a part of what we're doing. But I will say too, being a musician who started a label, there's a stigma attached to that. And it's a lot of uphill climbing for me, especially in the early part of it, because getting taken seriously as a label guy, when you've been an artist for so many years, most people go, oh, he's just a band guy starting a label. You know, so it was really hard to separate myself from that. And a big part of how I did that is I'm a big believer in, you know, surrounding yourself with the right people and the right team is how you build success, you know, to recognize talent in other people and the attributes they bring to the table. And one of my best friends who I went to high school with, played baseball with when I was younger, Nick Honorado, I brought him on board as my director of operations. And he's sort of the all business side of it. He's a musician as well, but that's what he's done in his career. And so we're able to have me on the far side and him on the far side and be able to understand the middle together. And that really helped us to be taken more seriously as a company. I think they realized as I brought in more pieces, it was like, oh, this is actually a thing. This isn't just going to be like a 6-month pet project kind of thing.
What's the hardest thing for you as an indie label?
I think nowadays is just the flood of everything that's out there. You know, it's not difficult to quote unquote start a label. You can just pick a name, slap a logo on it, and sign a band and say that you're a label. So I think the toughest part being an indie is becoming a competitive indie label. And I've done that through the artists that I've signed. You know, their word of mouth, the way when they sign here and the way they're treated and the way we take care of them, I think that's been the key to sort of climbing up that ladder a little bit. But I think it's just competing. The obvious thing would be competing financially. You know, the money is not just falling out of our pockets over here. You know, we have to be very strategic in how we spend, how we earn, where to spend it, and that sort of thing. But much like the DIY touring did for my band, from the decisions we made, I think it's going to help greatly when the money does start appearing in larger amounts, because we will have studied and learned how to run the label this way and not just rely on investors or, you know, just tons and tons of money to buy our way into things.
I couldn't really tell from your website. What are your releases like? Are you doing physical releases or is it just electronic releases?
Right. So we have the option through Sony. We can do, you know, brick and mortar if we want it to. That's going away so quickly, if you can even consider it still to exist. And I think to bring that on as an additional challenge for the type of label we are and the size label we are is just out of our scope. So what we do is everything is released digitally. We encourage streaming 100%. It's one of those things that the industry kind of fought against for so long. We're more of the, if that's what people are doing, then that's where we want to be. And one of our philosophies is if people are going to find music for free, let's just give it to them for free. So we do a lot of, you know, if you buy these merchandise products, you just get music and we'll just keep throwing music at you, because here's the thing, you're going to probably find a way to listen to it anyway. So why not have it come from us and have the perception be that Revival wants you to listen to this music? But in terms of physical product, we just try to do a lot of limited edition stuff, make the packaging as appealing as possible, that it's cool to own the item, still give them the digital music because that's probably how they're going to listen to it anyway. So we do mostly limited edition physical and digital streaming.
How do you feel about royalty payments through streaming?
It's an uphill battle. I wish it was more. It should be more. It gets better every year. It's certainly in very, very small steps. I think royalties and how they broke down even before streaming was a sensitive subject for most, especially being an artist. But it's just it's so difficult because all of it is there. Like if you take a Spotify, for example, like it's just like even me, cut the cord, so to speak, on buying music. I just subscribe to streaming. Now it was the hardest thing to do. I never wanted to do it. But again, if my values at the label are to try to keep up with time as much as we can, it felt foolish to me to not be subscribed to these things. And I think about that pretty often, like as I'm listening through music and I'm just like how people are getting paid fractions of pennies on these listens. But I honestly don't know how you fix it necessarily, because it's just so vastly available to everybody. And, you know, for these services to exist, the service also has to be benefiting.
Yeah, but the scale is different than the way it used to be. Like if you sold 1 million of anything, that was a lot and you made a fair amount of money. And now 1 million of streams or views is nothing. You're not even in the game. You know, 1 million is really is so small. So we really have to look at it differently. And I know you as a label owner do, but so many musicians, artists, bands, they don't think of that at all. They just think of, well, 1 million. Wow, that's a lot. Well, yeah, it is. But really, it's just hardly in the game anymore. It's a matter of scale.
Oh, yeah, certainly. Oh, yeah. I mean, in the way, you know, there's obviously tiers of a type of artist that you're looking at or band, but for me to consider an artist extremely successful, or at least in that ballpark, 8 figures worth of plays at least. I mean, you're talking 10 million before it's even like worth like a second glance. And it's just incredible because, you know, you think about a million plays, but how many people are creating those million plays? That's immediately where my mind goes to. You know, if you got your super fans sitting at home listening to your record 15 times a day, that million's going to come quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Well, again, that's something that we really can't measure right now. Who's listening? I mean, you know that those super fans are there, but it's really hard to get your arms around who those are, how many of them are as compared to your casual fans. It's tough. I think all that measurement, the advanced measurements are coming soon, and we'll see them, and it'll be less expensive. I know you can do it now to some degree, but it'll be less expensive. But boy, right now, it's hard to get your arms around.
Yeah, and you speak to you know, the advanced metrics and the ways we'll be able to measure these things. One of the things I want to be a pioneer for is looking at streaming as a way to measure a band's success in terms of landing, touring, and exposure. Because I think that the system that's in place now with record charting and things like that, and the way agents are picking their rosters and things, I think it's extremely antiquated in the sense that they still want to look at, say, first week record sales and things. And first week record sales matter if you're Kanye, right? Yeah, or if you're Adele, certainly. But they're the 1%. But you have a band that has generated like incredible buzz and can draw, you know, 75 to 100 kids a night on tour, but maybe they're only selling 1,500 copies first week. Maybe they're only selling 1,200 copies. But their album is streaming 25 million times. And I really think there needs to be a measurement in place that allows the industry to place more value on streaming in terms of us insiders measuring that success.
No, I think that's coming. Gradually, it's coming. You know, a real problem here is the changing of the guard. You know, you have a lot of established people that are sort of in a classic mindset. And as soon as you get the next generation coming on that thinks differently, I think that'll all change. But, it happens slowly. Although I think it's going a little faster now than it was. It was glacier speed for a bit, but I think it's coming fast.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned several episodes ago of your podcast about how so many of the very powerful people in music are now moving off into tech. And that to me is a scary changing of the guard too, because who are going to be the people who step up into the roles to help music move forward the way those folks did? It's nerve-wracking.
Well, okay, speaking of which, then, how do you feel you have an advantage over a major?
I like to think it's sort of a revolution, so to speak, where I always talk about I want grunge from the 90s to come back, because I want that idea of I don't care if this guitar is in tune. I don't care if this isn't the greatest song ever. I just want it to be music, right? And I'm hoping that the uprise of indie labels, which, you know, I'm a very small indie right now, but there are indie labels over the past couple of years who've gone on to accomplish incredible things, like Arise Records out of Portland, for example. I mean, they went from being as small as I am to being the label in this, you know, kind of part of the industry. And what I'm hoping is that it's an uprising of indies that say you don't have to spend millions of dollars to create success out of the art. You have to have the art and the artist speaking for it. And I think that's what indie labels are allowing to happen. We're giving the artist more of a voice again. We're not shelving records. We're not signing bands just to hide them from other artists that are succeeding in a similar way. And so what I hope to see more of, and I see a lot of it, but I want to see more of it, is our labels working together. Not making it so much of a competition on the indie scene, but making it where if we can all take our individual companies and create this revolution, then we can make it so that major labels don't own such a large piece of it.
It used to be like that, though. And I remember when I first came to LA and I had a deal on the table with Warner Brothers as a producer. And I thought, okay, I should probably go around and check some other labels. And I remember going into Atlantic and speaking with Stephen Cooper, who's still there, actually. And he said, you know, this isn't for us, but why don't you go see here. And he gave me three other people to go see at other labels. And, you know, it was just, well, we can't do this, so let me give it to somebody else that can. It was very, very cooperative. And that's kind of the way it felt for a long time, that it's like, well, hey, I'll compete with you if I have to, but if not, you know, then let's help each other out. You know, it was a nice way to be for a while.
Sure. And I think that is coming back in the indie scene. I'm very close with Tommy Lacomo, owns Tragic Hero Records, which is also based out of North Carolina. And we'll do that all the time. You know, I'll hear a band that I like and I just know it doesn't fit in necessarily with what I'm doing, but I'm like, I think this is something Tommy could really get behind, and I'll hand it off to him, and then hopefully he runs with it. But that's what I want. That's to me, that is the best. That's what this is all about, right? Yeah. This is about finding great art and exposing it to people.
Okay, so what is your label about then? So you know what your niche is and what you find attractive and what works. What is that, if you had to describe it?
Yeah, so we go by the mantra of good music by good people, and it's something we really hold ourselves to. It's not just a public sentiment to try and, you know, attract some eyes. This is something that we use as a gauge when we are making decisions. And for me, success and how to determine success as a label is the same way I've determined it as an artist for over a decade. It's that I want success to be the way we define it, not the way somebody tells us what success is supposed to be. And the world and the music industry is a very, very big place. And if we can just carve out a piece of it and succeed the way we want to succeed in that piece of it, then the goal from there would be to take that type of success and try and push it out a little bit, branch it out, and have more people subscribe to the way that we're doing it. You know, and it doesn't mean to say that we are, that it's our way or the highway or anything like that. I love seeing colleagues and whatnot succeed in their own manner. But for us, we're not going to let somebody else tell us how we're going to do things. This is the way we want to do it.
Yeah. But in terms of music, there must be a certain type of music that catches your ear that you go, this is perfect for the label. So how would you describe that?
It's interesting because I've had people tell me, oh, that sounds like your label. Like, we'll sign a band and be like, oh, that makes perfect sense with Revival. And I'll just go, I guess we have a sound then. I don't know that I necessarily ever was like gravitating towards any particular sound. I guess my own personal taste and that combination of taste sort of just shines through in the artist that I decide to pursue. I guess I can see the similarities in the type of people that I sign, but musically, like I said, Kid in the Candy Store, like if I really love it, you can ask the folks I work with. I'm like, I want that band. We're going to go get that band. We signed a band out of Salt Lake City recently named Charlatan. And from the first half of the song I heard, like, it's all I would talk about for weeks. I'm like, we are signing this band. We are signing this band. Like, no matter what it takes, I'm getting this band. And So I've signed heavy stuff. I've signed slightly indie stuff. I really just like signing stuff that I enjoy. I've received advice from some label owners in the past that say, you know, this is a business. Don't forget, you know, you can't just love everything you sign. You need to be able to look at it objectively. And I would say at this point, I probably have a few more pet projects than maybe some labels would have. But I've gotten better at that, at trying to look at it through a more objective lens.
Yeah, but Sean, I can tell you that I go back to the 70s, maybe the best time ever to be in the music business. And mostly because the label owners of the time thought like you, and even on the major scale, they were lovers of music, and they only signed people that they liked. And if they didn't, it didn't matter whether they can make money or not. I mean, eventually it got to that when the suits took over. But in the beginning, the label owners were music lovers. And you could look at Atlantic with Ahmet Erdogan. He only signed people he liked, and Jerry Wexler and those guys. And the same thing at Warner Brothers. Warner's, you know, they didn't care if it took you four albums or five albums to break. They loved you and they would stand by you. And you know, it wasn't a money thing, and you have to make it. But on the other hand, you have to love the people that you're working with. And that was the case. And that's the way it should be, really. Right? And that's why you're doing this.
Absolutely. And, you know, I preach passion. That's what I preach to my artists. It's what I preach to my team. And I guess it would be a little hypocritical of me if I didn't sign things I was passionate about. And that's the thing, is when I go into the office every day and I have to get excited about doing what I do, I want to love the bands. I do. I want to love the music. I want that to be the music I'm listening to throughout the day in the office. And yeah, you're right. I mean, the music industry would certainly be a wonderful place if that's what happened. People just signed what they loved and passionately promoted it.
Well, with the labels, it's not quite going to happen, with the majors anyway. What is your pitch to a band that you really like? Because I would think that a lot of them would say, well, hey, we can do a lot of this ourselves now.
Sure. I think what it is we've, you know, the state of affairs is now, you know, social media reach, YouTube reach, that sort of thing. So we have a pretty high subscribership for our YouTube channel. for the size label that we are. So that's one of our big sales points. If we have to have one, is, you know, you can put your video out now to your 150 subscribers, or you can put your video out now to our 30,000 plus subscribers. But a big thing that I'm able to pitch out to bands is that I've been in your shoes. I've sat in your seat exactly. I've been signed to three different record labels. And, you know, if a label is something you're seeking, my label is where you want to be, because I'm going to see things through your lens. And a large majority of the bands that I've signed who have had other labels as options have ultimately said that they landed here because they trusted me. And so that's the big thing I preach with my artists, is that you can trust me implicitly with your career. I would never do anything to harm it. If the time comes where you've outgrown this, I will help you find a bigger pair of shoes, kind of thing.
Again, that's the thinking the way it used to be way back when. I'm happy that it's coming back, that attitude is you're rekindling it. It's great. Makes me feel good about the business again.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't see it any other way. If you sign a band because you love them, wouldn't you want to see them succeed as go as high as they can? You still, just because they move on to a larger label because they need to, doesn't mean that I wasn't a part of that journey, you know, and that, again, defining success the way I want to.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's several ways to define success, and one way is money. So if you're looking at it from a financial standpoint solely, then you know, that limits you in how that works. But if that's not your sole criteria, and everybody needs money to keep going, and you want to make a little more than you spend, but on the other hand, if that's not your sole criteria, it just changes the whole thing, whole dynamic of it. And people can feel that.
Right. Yeah, and I've always been a big believer of, if you set your goals a certain way and you move towards them the way you want to, that the money will come eventually. That mm-hmm. that part of the success will come. If you create a successful environment and you preach success in the way that you want it to be, eventually the financial success will come along with it.
Okay, so let's talk strategy a little bit. So since you're doing mostly digital releases, are you asking for an album or an EP from a band, or does it matter if you just get singles when you get them?
So singles are tough in the indie game, only because of the short attention span of this generation right now. Singles make me nervous. At least that's my philosophy. It's just, if we're going to go to the bottom of strategy here, if it's a brand new band, a band that's fairly underexposed, I always like to launch with an EP. I think an EP is a great way to get interest from fans, but not overwhelm them. Sometimes it's a brand new band, 11, 12 tracks, and just be a little bit too much. It waters down. The back half of the album never gets listened to anyway.
Yeah.
So why make the back half of the album? You can see, just go on the back end of Spotify or YouTube or anything, and you'll just watch the numbers trickle down as the album goes on. So we have found that between 4 and 6 songs is about the strong attention span for new artists. So why not just make that 4 to 6 song record and have it be that? And then you can strategize what to do from there based on that success, whether it's, okay, let's drop a single now to keep that interest up while the LP gets written, or move right into an LP. We occasionally will launch with a single, but that's knowing that the EP or the LP is coming, kind of thing. But I would be extremely hesitant to just, I don't think I would sign a band on a single alone. I would want to see more depth in the writing, for sure.
Well, I'm not saying that would be the case, that you'd sign them on a single alone, but the strategy of releasing singles and releasing them mm-hmm. every month or 6 weeks or whatever, so there's a continuous stream of music that's coming out and it's new all the time, as compared to one release that's, you know, 4 or 6 songs or 8 songs or 10, whatever it might be. And there's only one event at that point that you can promote, rather than multiple events. You know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah. So one thing, because we love content, visual content, content is king these days. And one of the strategies we discussed with an artist we just signed is that very idea, is do we put out a record or do we get something shot for every one of these songs and sort of make it an annual campaign to where new events are happening over the course of the entire year, whether it's just a new song or whether it's just, you know, a new item in between, kind of thing, to where you're slowly developing the interest over that time. And then at the end of that cycle, you drop something big. You collectively make it an LP, maybe with a couple additional tracks and that sort of thing. Because again, to me, your biggest competitor is just attention. There's just so, I mean, there's always been a lot of musicians, always been a lot of bands, but these days it's just, it's unbelievable to me just how many bands are accessible and out there and all competing for the same attention in the same spots.
So how do you do it then? How do you get the attention?
I think it's that when we really got the wheels rolling on Revival, it was, let's build the company before we build the artist. Let's make it so that Revival is a place people want to stop to see things. And that has worked. The culture we've built, it gets talked about. When we put out videos, there's always comments that mention our culture and the way we find bands and the way that we do things. And I think that's what's allowing us to separate the bands that we sign from the rest of the pack of unsigned artists. We are a landing spot for people to go find new music, and that helps us in that competitive, you know, claustrophobic setting.
Are you paying for the videos and for the production of the EP, you know, releases, or is that coming from mostly from the bands?
I try to get as creative and specific with my deals to each artist. There are certain artists that come on board who they get it. They have their whole visual thing in place. They've got a friend who does music videos, that sort of thing. And to me, I'd rather not, you know, wrinkle the sheets on that. I'd rather let them just keep on doing their thing and find other ways to compensate them and make it enticing financially for them to come on board. And then there's other artists who go, we wrote these songs, we have no idea what to do. In which case, I've got, you know, a team of trusted people that I've worked with over the years. A big thing we love to work with is hungry up-and-coming artists in all avenues. I find you get the quickest work, the best work, the hungriest work that way.
That makes sense. Okay, so I saw something, maybe it was from the email that you sent me, Revival Rock School. What's that about?
So there was a franchise of rock schools started by Scott Marcerin in New Jersey called Let There Be Rock School. And an attorney friend of mine in the music industry, Scott Bradford, he opened one up with a partner in Durham, which is about 45 minutes from here. And he asked me to get involved. And for about the first year or so I was teaching some classes and things. And it's just the commute got to be too much, especially our second son was born and it was just too much going on. But I stayed very closely in touch with them because the area that I live in here in North Raleigh is a booming part of North Carolina. I mean, just demographically, just much larger than Durham, a lot more disposable income in this part of the state. And so I mentioned to them I wanted to franchise out here and open it up. But the one thing I wanted to do was brand it myself, because not that they're not doing a great job there in Durham, but I'm building a synergy here with the name Revival. Everything we do is kind of under that umbrella. So, and once they approved that, I got the green light. And so working now on just whether or not, I don't want to roll it out too quickly because I want to do it right. I really was hoping to have summer camps open this summer to launch in the fall. That's still the goal temporarily, but in any event, without a doubt, by 2018, Revival Rock School will be open here in Raleigh. And the idea there is I want to teach. It's not just lessons. It's not just how to play guitar, how to play drums. It is learning the music industry from as young an age as possible. And not just the boring business side of it, but how music can be a career still, even today. And there's so many, when I was teaching my bands at the school I was working at previously, I would make them load their gear in and out. I would teach them how to wind their cables up, you know, just these little things you can learn along the way that kind of put you a step ahead if this is where you choose to go.
Very cool. Very cool. Okay, so you wrote a novel. How do you have time for all that?
Ask my wife and she will tell you she has no idea where I squeeze in this stuff. I don't even know. I feel like sometimes I go away and I wake up and then that project is done. Like it's absolutely crazy. The book is something I'd wanted to do. We did the trilogy of albums with Alisena, and after the first one was when we decided we wanted it to be a trilogy. And it was right around that point I started to toy with the idea of, maybe we turn this into a novel kind of thing. And I talked with my co-creator about it, and he was supportive. And I just one day was like, I'm going to do it. I've always wanted to write a book. I'm just going to do it. And, you know, kind of put everything else aside for a little bit and just ripped through it as quickly as I could. I teased my wife. I kind of looked like a detective on a serial case, a murder case or something, because I had sticky notes all over my office room, and it looked like a crazy person was in that room for like 3 months straight. But it was a lot of fun, super challenging. Honestly, the most challenging thing I've ever done was complete that novel.
Yeah, when I did my first book, I had the same reaction. It was like, man, too many brain cells died. I'm never going to do that again.
Oh, yeah. You spend the next week just not understanding how you're ever going to be creative again. You're like, I just don't know where I'm going to find it. And then eventually, like everything else, it comes back to you. But that first week after, I was like, I'm never writing a song, a book, nothing ever again. I am done with the whole thing.
Yep. No, just what you mean. Definitely. Okay. Last question for you, Sean. You've had a journey, an interesting journey that's probably different than most musicians, in that you've experienced the business end of things much more so than most musicians, artists ever do. So is there a business aha moment that happened to you? Did you get some advice from somebody that maybe really made a difference, or is there something that you learned where the light just went on?
I think it was through my manager for very many years, who I consider to be my mentor in the industry, Eric Rushing, who is the founder of All Things Artery. It was learning. First of all, one thing he taught me that I would never forget, and I still preach this day, was as an artist, don't forget that your managers, your agents, they work for you. And I think maybe years and years ago that was made quite clear, but I think there was kind of a guise going on in the industry today where it made it seem like it was the other way around. And he was like, oh, never forget that. Never forget that they work for you. But the biggest thing I learned from him was actually when he would get mad at me, or when he would tell me I was wrong. That was really when I realized that, oh, artists don't know everything and we're not always right. And having that understanding and having that realization with him telling me that was really when I started to dig in on that side of it. It was like, well, what is right and what wrong? And when is it right and when is it wrong? And I got just so interested in that side of it. That's when I really started to passionately build what I was eventually going to try and do. That's when I started taking the notes. And that's when I really started talking to everybody that I met and everything like that. Because I was like, wow, I guess that was when I realized that the music industry was just that. It was an industry. It was like any other business. And I'd studied business when I was in school, and I guess it never occurred to me until the first time he gave me a hard time. I was like, oh, this is a business. People are trying to make money, and there's tons of different ways to make money. And yeah, that was definitely my light bulb moment of, okay, I can actually make this a long-term career.
To find out more about Sean and Revival Recordings, go to revivalrex.com, Revival Rex, R-E-C-S, not recordings, revivalrex.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, you can go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.